Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Enrolled members of the Northern Cheyenne Nation, Bentley Spang and Cinnamon Spear are using a variety of media to tell powerful stories of their land and culture.
Bentley Spang is a multidisciplinary artist, curator, educator, and writer working in mixed media sculpture, video, performance, and installation. His work lately has been focused on a performance piece entitled Techno Powwow, an installation work focused on digital technology and representations of war shirts entitled Modern Warrior Series.
Cinnamon Spear is a writer and filmmaker whose art provides a true representation of her people and personal history. Currently, Cinnamon is studying fiction at the coveted Iowa Writers' Workshop.
Cinnamon Spear is a beadwork artist, writer, and film director. Raised in a large family in the Northern Cheyenne Reservation in Lame Deer, Montana, her art provides a true representation of her people and her personal history.
Welcome to the studio, Cinnamon. So honored to have you here.
Thank you. I'm blessed to be here.
You were the first Lame Deer High School student to attend an Ivy League school and get your master's. Talk a little bit about that pathway that led you into pursuing your degree.
I would have to start by saying both of my parents were college educated at the University of Montana. So I realized that growing up on the reservation, I was very privileged to have both parents as role models.
Was that unusual?
Yes, I do believe so. My dad actually attended a few years of Lewis and Clark Law School, which was monumental at the time. He was one of the first Native Americans to be at that level. I think at the time it was ranked as the highest law school in the country. So he didn't complete his degree, nor did my mom. So I felt like I very much so took on the path of higher education to do it kind of in their honor. But education was very much expected in our household and talked about a lot that we had to go to college. So I definitely had that influence at home, and I knew some of my best friends in school from, you know, sixth grade on didn't have that voice in their home. So I definitely have to give thanks to my parents for leading the way. And for my path personally, I would say I would attend the summer programs that were both at University of Montana and Montana State. And I think those six-week summer enrichment programs, I went to the MAP program, the Montana yeah. Apprenticeship Program is a six-week program. And I went when I was 15, and I participated in research programs on campus there and built relationships with people on campus. And being housed on the college university for the summer really broadened my experience and put me on campus and was very monumental, I think, in letting me know that I had a place there.
We're going to make you a spokesperson for the education system here in Montana.
Yes, for sure.
But it's really surprising. You graduated from Dartmouth. That is a big deal. In 2009 in Native American Studies?
Yes.
So was it a difficult transition from going to Lame Deer to Dartmouth?
It was very difficult in a number of ways. One quick little story I share is that my freshman year roommate, I come from a big family on a rural, you know, impoverished reservation, and my freshman year roommate was a wealthy only child, Jewish girl from New York City. So we couldn't have been more different, and we had to live together in the same room. What probably saved me, I think, was the Native American community at Dartmouth. My dorm was really close to the Native American house, and so it was a place where we could all gather and share stories and go for support. And if it wasn't for those students, I think I would have had a much harder time, because if we had these daily almost microaggressions or encounters that were hard for us, we could all kind of convene and say, this happened and this happened, and someone was right there to support you. At the same time, the Native community at Dartmouth was a little challenging for me, because I expected that everyone there had come fresh off the reservation like I had and had left a family and a community and a history and a home on the lands that, you know, their tribe had come from, and that was not the case. I found it difficult to transition with the wealth, class issues that were there. On a very basic level, the trees were claustrophobic for me, coming from Montana and coming from Big Sky Country. I sometimes would feel like the sky was so small and I couldn't breathe.
And you then returned back to Lame Deer to finish your master's thesis, this
yes.
documentary titled Pride in Basketball.
Yes.
I'm curious about how filmmaking and also basketball entered into your life.
So growing up on the reservation, I think basketball is in everyone's life from day one. Myself, particularly, I was not blessed with the skills that many people were. Mm-hmm. To be a star on the court, definitely I was more of a star in in the classroom. So I wanted to use this master's thesis as a way to highlight the story of my people. And I was influenced in film by a filmmaker named Alanis Obomsawin, who's an Abenaki filmmaker from Canada. Mm-hmm. She works for the National Film Board of Canada, and she was a visiting Montgomery fellow at Dartmouth, and she needed a teacher's assistant. So I was assigned that role to support her in the class. And I helped TA this documentary film class, and I had no goal to make film, really. But I just saw how images with words can just impact people so quickly. And the difference between film and writing is that, say, if I were to write a book, it would take the time it would take for 100 people to read that book is dependent upon that person. And that's assumingly a lot of time. Whereas you can put 100 people in a room and press play on a film, and 30 minutes later, everyone traveled that same journey together. And
yeah,
I thought
really
that was
impactful.
Right.
I saw your film, and again, you have never filmed anything before.
No.
And you had a little camera that you did it with.
Yes.
But it's such a compelling story. Have you thought about going back and doing that again, or fixing it up and making it into a documentary?
The film as is, I consider a final product at this point. You're right in that I did not have training. I have used writing as a basis to tell stories. And one day I just decided I'm going to pick up this little handheld camera and visually tell a story. And the whole time I was doing it, I wholeheartedly learned why the term film crew exists. Because you need someone to pay attention to lighting, to sound, the interview, scheduling rooms, making sure people are where they need to be, directing, self-directing, producing, and editing. The film was very much a challenge, but it was a learning process the entire way. And I see how powerful film is. I do think in the future I will continue to make films, but currently being at the writing program that I'm at right now, writing is my focus currently. But what was important for me to do while I was there was kind of hand the camera off to some of the students to get them behind the camera, because I want them to know that everyone has the power to make a film and you don't need a lot of equipment. People who have iPhones now have a camera and they have iMovie on their phones. And so anyone who wants to tell a visual story has the tools right in their hands.
It is a tool. It's a storytelling tool. So it's interesting being a writer and a poet and transposing your thoughts about Native culture. It seemed to work pretty well for you.
With that version of the film, I had to very much so incorporate some of my narrative over the film. So it did allow me the chance to kind of incorporate my poetry or incorporate my personal perspective. And I felt like while I was making the film Pride in Basketball, I had to be a cross-cultural communicator. So teaching the outside world kind of about my home and about the love and passion that exists there. But also I had to raise certain issues for my own community tied to education with basketball in the film. So I was kind of telling a dual narrative to dual audiences with one piece, which I almost find is the struggle that I have in almost any piece of art that I create. But I'm definitely trying to figure out a balance.
As an educator, you are also empowering young students to, you know, pick up a pencil, pick up a camera or a phone, you say. You're traveling to high schools and colleges around the country sharing your story. What are some of the things that you share with the students?
I'm very open with my storytelling and my sharing with the students. And I get very personal and I talk about the struggles that were in my home when I talk to students. Because I feel like sometimes when we're in those situations where maybe we see drugs or we see alcohol and we see violence, we think we're doomed. We think there's not a future for us. And I tell the students that because in my experience, I was told by family members, by my best friends, by teachers, that I wasn't going to amount to anything. Sometimes I felt maybe I wouldn't go to college. Maybe I could not achieve an Ivy League education, a master's degree. Now I'm working on my second master's degree. And what that boiled down to was me creating a voice inside myself that every time someone said something negative, I had a counter narrative to say, no, that's not the truth. I'm going to do it. So when I speak to the kids, I really encourage them to find that voice or develop it, because a lot of us don't have it. You have to cultivate that voice that tells you that you deserve it, you're worth it, you can do it, and you're not going to give up.
Now, did you cultivate a lot of these skills as well with some of your previous work? I know that you were on the Pine Ridge Reservation and at the Red Cloud Indian School. What was your work there like with those younger students?
So actually, when I worked with Red Cloud Indian School, I was a Foundations and Corporate Relations Associate. I didn't have the opportunity, unfortunately, to work one-on-one with students there. I was more in the fundraising office, and what that allowed me to do was to help the philanthropic team there tell the story of what Red Cloud was doing. As far as, for one example, would be the Lakota Language Program. They have a K-12 comprehensive program, and so the way we have to pitch that to partners who want to be a part of it, they were speaking of it almost in a distanced way about how it's, you know, a language program. And so with me having a Native perspective, I was able to offer sentences like, you know, your partnership in this program or in funding this program is allowing these students to speak the same language their ancestors spoke and revives the songs, the culture, the spirituality if you help with this program. And so it's really having an Indigenous perspective, speaking from the community for the community, that I think is the most important thing.
Well, and that certainly comes from your writing and your poetry. And although you are a filmmaker now, I think really your foundation is in your writing.
Absolutely.
I know a lot of your work is based certainly on your life story. Mm-hmm. And what's the difference then with the fiction? Does it allow you a different path?
As far as my writing is concerned, yes, a lot of it is autobiographical. The best thing I can say about fiction is it allows me to take certain life instances, maybe that had crossed different years, and put them in the same context. So even though they're drawn from this sort of truth, the ability for the story to be able to compound and amplify these instances, that's what fiction allows, is to be able to take those things and piece them together in a way that makes sense in a more concise way. I think my life is the best thing that I know. And my first fiction professor, when I studied at Dartmouth College, my first degree was a Master's of Arts in Liberal Studies. My professor there taught me always to write what you know, because if you're writing things that you don't know, the people who know that are going to be able to see through it. And so my life is always going to be the basis probably for all my work.
And that certainly comes true in the line from your essay that was published at the Cornell University Press. And they were Native American college students telling life stories. But the title of the book is actually I Am Where I Come From, which is from your essay.
Yes. So my closing paragraph, I say that I'm from the Morning Star people. The Northern Cheyenne people are known as the Morning Star people. And I definitely have always said that I'm the hills raised me. It's my land that has raised me. So I close by saying at the core of my identity is the land. It is who I am, and I am where I come from. That will always remain true, no matter how much time I spend off the reservation, no matter where my life's travels take me. Every time I descend down into that valley, into Lame Deer, into the valley of the Northern Cheyenne, as I call it, my spirit is home, and I'm tied, and I'm centered, and I'm strong every time I take another adventure out of there.
What continues to drive you?
When I was younger, I used to fear failure. I would say I'm afraid of failure because we've had so many greats, whether they're basketball players or students who are very intelligent and bright, just not quite make it out. And I was afraid of failing. And so that fear of failure drove me a lot. When I got to Dartmouth, though, I realized I'm not going to fail. No matter what direction I go in, it can't be considered failure. I'm at this level. Instead of kind of that negative, I'm afraid to fail, now I'm just so much more motivated by continuing to achieve, climbing these ladders that, you know, the greater American society, you know, the Ivy League school being very prestigious and selective. It's my goal now to continue to climb these ladders that society sees as quote unquote successful without compromising any part of who I am as an Indigenous person, as a Native person, as a Cheyenne woman.
I also love that you talk about writing as both your sanctuary but also your duty.
I've always used writing to heal. So if I had a bad experience at home, if I had a bad experience at school, if my best friend was mean to me, I would always turn to writing for as far back as I could remember because I didn't have the language or the voice to communicate emotional issues, I think. So I would just very internally, that's why I say sanctuary. It was where I went to put things down on paper to be able to let it go, to heal, to move on, to live the next day. I also now see that it's my duty and that I serve as this cross-cultural communicator to be able to educate non-Natives about a Native experience, but also to go home and educate my own people and the youth about what my experience is like off the reservation. And I think the more we continue to build those bridges, the better the world will be, hopefully.
Oh, agreed. Thank you so much, Cinnamon Spear, for being here. We appreciate your time and your enthusiasm and your energy towards the art of writing and sharing that love with other people.
Thank you.
Best of luck.
Thank you. Mia-ish.
Welcome to the studio, Bentley Spang.
Hi, Bentley.
Hi.
Nice to have you here today.
Great to be here. Great to be here.
Bentley, you're such a multidisciplinary artist. You have so many different mediums that you work through, sculpture, video, performance, installation. I'm curious about how much of your work is autobiographical, or really addressing that cultural identity as a member of the Cheyenne tribe living in, you know, today's society, making art.
Right. Yeah. Pretty much all of it is, you know, that was something I came to early on, that, you know, this is what I needed to talk about. This was, you know, for me to share my experience as a creative person, that's where the focus needed to be, was on that experience. And I also, growing up, you know, on and off the reservation, I saw that there wasn't much awareness of our experience out there in the mainstream, and that, you know, just an incredible history. We are, you know, a huge chunk of the history of this country, and it wasn't being spoke about, and it still isn't to a great degree, but, you know, it's gotten somewhat better.
You know, we talked to Jean Quick to see Smith, and she told this really wonderful story about being so poor, but as a child, she would go out and scratch pictures in the mud. And it was so powerful to hear that story. What brought you to art making?
You know, I grew up with artists all around me. You know, there were aunts that were bead workers, cousins that drew and painted. You know, my grandparents on my dad's side were both really well-known hide tanners. And people would come from all over to get their hides. So there was always creative activity around me, no matter where I was at. We moved to Alaska when I was, you know, in third grade, and we got surrounded by artists up there too. You know, some of the carvers, Tlingit carvers and stuff, Ray Nielsen and different ones. And so just everywhere I went, there was art.
And so you were nurtured along the way of your artistic career.
Exactly,
that's great.
Exactly.
So now you graduated from Montana State University, Billings, and then you earned a Master's of Fine Arts degree at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And then, of course, you've gone on to teach at numerous institutions. What's the focus of your teaching, or what do you want your students to take away?
Well, I think, you know, for me, the creative process has been such a powerful force in my life. It's a restorative process. It's a, you know, it's a multifunctional process. It's sort of... as an artist, I think you sort of try to find what that function is, what your function is as an artist, and what your work, the function of that work is. And so that's what I encourage my students to look for, is first of all to see, you know, what are the multiple functions of art in the world, from sort of Western European art to the art from my cultural background to, you know, Eastern, you know, Asian art. There's all these different roles for art in the community, and it's sort of finding that role and then just trying to fulfill that, you know, as an artist. So.
That's interesting, because I think people think of art, they think of like oil paints and a canvas, or a pencil and a pad or something. And you've talked a lot about how creative Native Americans were into adapting material, European materials, into artwork. And that certainly shows up in a lot of your work.
When I look back at the work, you know, that the ancestral work that came before me, I just saw that artists were grabbing whatever they could around them, whatever was there, to express their experience. And sometimes it was, you know, what we would call traditional materials, you know, materials that were created within the community. And then sometimes it was, you know, materials that came from outside the community. And I always use beadwork as the classic example. Mm-hmm. You know, glass beads came from Europe. But the artists saw the potential for them and really were able to harness that power of the bead.
Bentley, you were so creative. I was blown away when I saw your presentation that you used burned trees to make drawings, and right. It was so powerful. Tell a little bit about how you came to that.
Again, it was that sort of fearlessness of my relatives in the past that that helped me kind of find my expanse of mediums, you know, and realize that I could just use whatever's in front of me today. And, you know, some of what I think I was trying to express in terms of, you know, that not having those materials or not having that so much fearlessness, that really was about the authenticity that's put on us as Native artists today. If you don't sort of follow this formula, then is that really Native art? And so when I did this, the piece with the trees, you know, I've been doing a lot of work about my homeland and, you know, the power of that place for us. And how
and a good part of your ranch burned.
Yes. Yeah. Most of the my parents' ranch burned, and, you know, it's taken a number of years to get back to it. So I wanted to kind of, you know, that relationship that I have with the land that I've built over the years that all Cheyenne people have on some level with our homeland. I wanted to talk about that directly and also give the land a chance to speak. And so I saw myself as a facilitator of these trees. You know, I thought, you know, I've been telling my story of the fire. What about these trees? What about their story of it? And so I just kind of let my story go and just focused on doing these drawings with the trees and rubbing on the trees with these with this drawing paper. And their story came through. And so then I understood that I was there to kind of facilitate that story.
And you know what? Those are beautiful drawings, but that's really spooky.
Well, you love working in charcoal and drawing. I've read that you draw till your arms almost fall off. What attracts you to drawing specifically?
You know, I think the sort of mark making and the immediacy of drawing is really has always attracted me. And I think just seeing a piece develop in front of me, you know, on a piece of paper. And charcoal in particular, I've been drawn to because I think it engages so much of you physically. To, you know, the way I deal with it is with hands, and, you know, by the time I'm done with the drawing, I'm covered with charcoal. So it's like a very physical medium, and I've always been very tactile, you know.
And it's very organic.
It's very organic, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, so when it came to doing the On Fire piece that you talked about, you know, the charcoal was already there. You know, it was there in these entities and these trees that I grew up.
So the trees provided the material. I love that. I mean, you just brought the paper to them to tell their stories. Wow.
Yeah. It was an amazing cathartic and helped me, you know, to deal with the fire because that was a very emotional kind of thing, losing the place and having to rebuild. And
yeah, there's something cyclical in fire and in working in charcoal.
And I think the just understanding the function of art in my community as a sometimes a healing activity or action helped me to see that, you know, I can go to those actions and it can benefit me and help me get through things as well. So
you talk about healing, and also humor is an important part of your work as well.
Yeah, humor, it's one of our greatest, I think, tools to survive what we had to survive. You know, we went through a lot of difficult things, my people. And humor, I think, really helped us to put it in perspective. To, you know, somebody once told me, you know, sometimes you have to laugh to keep from crying, you know. And I think, you know, the humor that I've seen in my community and grew up with, that's also a sign of intellect. Mm. I always say the funniest people in my community are, you know, sort of PhD level folks, you know, because you got it. When you're in a group of Cheyenne people and they're teasing back and forth, if you're not pretty smart, you can't.
Yeah, you got to keep up.
There, yeah, they'll burn you.
People that don't know Native people, whenever I talk about how funny Crow and Cheyenne people can be, they look at me like, "What? What are you talking about?" I said, "You have no idea how much laughter is a part of the culture."
Absolutely. Well, and that's what I always, you know, talk about. You know, in the past, there was probably a lot of laughter happening in the hills. You know, I can just imagine my relatives, you know, cracking up just constantly. You know? There had to be some people that were, you know, kind of running the humor all the time, you know, and in charge of it. So so I've tried to take that on somewhat in my work. And, you know, my work, I've really tried to look at what the artists in the past were doing and try to keep that way of creating, that sort of spirit of creating going. And so, you know, I'm willing to work in a lot of different mediums and a lot of different modalities to express my experience because they were, you know.
So let's jump to what you're doing now. Wow.
Yeah, what's your current work focused on?
Well, I've been doing a couple different things. One is this series called Techno Powwow. Mm. And Techno Powwow, let's see, how many have I done so far? Four, I believe. And they came out of my experience with rave culture back in the early 90s when I was in grad school. And I was struck by the similarities in atmosphere and in music and movement to the powwows that I grew up with. And so at one point at a rave, I just thought, what would happen if you dropped a fancy dancer into this rave right now? Mm. And I knew that they would just tear it up. You know, they would just like love that atmosphere and feed off it. So that stuck with me. And then I just developed this series, bringing together powwow and break dancers a lot of times to interact with each other and then to challenge each other to do a battle. And so it's this great, you know, it's been called a mashup of cultural mashup. And, you know, it's sort of comparing how we express ourselves in terms of dance and music across cultures, you know, and how similar it is, how different it is, how can we learn from each other. And so, yeah, there just been these wonderful exchanges of, you know, powwow and breakdancers across country. So
tell us about your most recent piece, which I'd love.
Oh, that
you're
one.
Into the whole video installation. I mean, your last piece was 21 feet long by 9 feet tall, a giant installation. Tell us about that piece.
That was a piece called War Shirt, the Modern Warrior Series, War Shirt number 6, Waterways. And it's a piece I've been dreaming about doing for a long time. I've been doing these war shirt, I call them war shirts. They're not actual, you know, war shirts, but they use that war shirt form to express kind of the importance of community, land, and place. And, you know, I talk a lot about the homeland in them, but I've used photographs, you know, I've made them out of photographs for a number of years, since about 1998. And I've done 5 of the photographic ones. And then in the back of my mind, I've always wanted to do one out of video screens. This is a war shirt blown up, you know, to epic proportion. The photographic war shirts are more human scale. You know, they're based on the size of my frame. And to be able to do this in video was a really interesting shift and, you know, a logical sort of development in that series, the War Shirt series, because, you know, video, film, it's all based on the single still image. So it's just an animation of stills.
This is hard for people to even understand. We are going to provide a link to some of your work on our website so you can actually see the war shirt installation, and it's a powerful thing. So, Bentley, thank you for being in our studio.
Yes, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Anna Page, Corby Skinner, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.